Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Owens Corning of New England, helping homeowners create living space using the Owens Corning basement finishing system for over 20 years. More information at ocboston.com.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. A woman chef reaches for the stars and ends up with three Michelins, making her the first woman in the United States to receive the highest honor from the esteemed guide. Speaking of stardom, does the latest romaine E. coli outbreak mean it's the tip of the iceberg for another lettuce's popularity? Think about that for a minute. Call me in the morning. Joining us to talk about this, the new farm bill, other headlines about food, culture, and policy, is food writer Corby Kummer. Corby's a senior editor at The Atlantic, a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a BPR contributor. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Hello there.
So it's like food day here today at Boston Public Radio. Yeah, we got Corby Kummer. This morning we have Jacques Pepin.
Jacques Pepin and his son-in-law,
who are running this big event tomorrow at BU about culinary 30 years of helping people with their cooking there. And we're going to have Dori Greenspan is ending the show with her great new cookbook. And in the middle we have Corby Kummer. A chef sandwich.
You are a chef sandwich today.
The white Oreo cream. I've always wanted to be white Oreo
cream.
That's
a beautiful way to put it.
So,
thank you.
So tell us about the Nobel Peace Prize nominee that is a rather famed chef now and a good friend of the President of the United States.
He is such a good friend of the President of the United States that they were engaged in a lawsuit, which they settled out of court. This is the great Jose Andres in Washington, who has become more and more of an activist as he opened restaurants that are completely my go-tos and standbys in Washington, Mediterranean, Spanish, Mexican, Chinese. Peruvian.
My favorite is him, too, the Z one. Wasn't that him?
Zaitinha.
Zaitinha, isn't that him?
Yes, you're welcome for my telling you
best
have to
Brussels
go there.
Sprouts
That's
in America.
That's where we went, Jim. Remember that they with are, our crew?
Yes, I do.
And fresh-baked pita bread that comes out of the bread machine every 5 minutes.
Oh, my
and
God.
They keep dangerously refilling it. So great restaurants like this. That is my favorite of them, Zaitinha Oyamel. But aside from creating exciting, terrific dining environments, he has become a feed-the-hungry, go-in-and-get-the-job-done in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, and feed thousands of people and mobilize troops on the ground, find where the facilities are, where it can be made, and do it. Now, it wasn't just Hurricane Maria. He's Spanish from Catalonia, but this was in Puerto Rico, so naturally he had some kind of Latino sympathy he talked about a lot. But he had done it in Haiti for years in a clean cook stove movement that he was taking all over the world, but especially mobilizing in Haiti. So he'd worked with the State Department for years. I think he's a great candidate for the Nobel Prize. I'm so unimaginative it would not have occurred to me, but I'm so glad that he's been nominated. And he's saying modestly, they nominate everybody.
Well, also, I would assume, and I mean this sincerely, he's got a leg up because I'm sure the Nobel Committee would love to do a slap in the face to Donald Trump. And for those who don't know, the first time we ever talked with you about Jose Andres is after Marjorie and I got back from our inaugural week in Washington. We went into the Trump Hotel where there was supposed to be a Jose Andres restaurant, but there ended up not being because Andres was upset about the disparaging remarks that candidate Trump made about Mexicans.
Yeah, rapists,
tried to pull out
murderers.
Exactly.
Drug
and then ultimately that thing was settled. But this guy not only does wonderful work, he's obviously a person of principle big time.
Yeah, he took a stand, and this is a beautiful property in Washington, an 1880s Romanesque revival, the old post office
building. It is
gorgeous.
Beloved, beautifully restored. And what a shame that it's now. When I did a piece about the Trump winery, the only place you can buy it is in that old post office building in Washington, the Trump International Hotel. And I said in Vanity Fair it had the grim bonhomie of Maxim's in occupied Paris. So you go into like enemy territory. But Andres decided to pull out. And this was, you know, before Trump was even nominated.
So this next story about restaurants, how restaurants got so loud, it's like a hallelujah for me because it seems as though every place I go, especially if you're spending, you know, a good amount of money, and you feel like you have to shout at people, where you're so close to someone at the next table that you can't have any kind of private discussion anymore.
Well, now that you say this, I will admit that your wonderful guest, Dori Greenspan, with whom I'll be doing a talk tonight.
You're doing a thing with her tonight?
I'm doing a thing with her at Harvard Bookstore.
I know it's our bookstore. I don't know you were the interviewer.
PM.
Cookbook is fantastic.
I am, and I'm looking for a restaurant to take her to, and I have several I want to go to in Cambridge, but all I'm thinking about is what's the noise level. And what I don't remember if the Boston Globe does ratings. So here's a piece.
Of sound, you mean?
Yeah.
In their reviews? I don't know if they do.
Well, the Washington Post does.
Does
because
it? Do
Tom
really?
Sitsima carries around a decibel measurer, and so he takes readings whenever he's whenever he reviews.
That is a great idea.
And he says it, and I think that the Times critics also have a decibel meter, but I know that Tom does it. His counterparts at the San Francisco Chronicle do it. But here's a piece by Kate Wagner, whom I don't know. I emailed the terrific tech editor of The Atlantic. It ran in the tech section of The Atlantic about why did restaurants get so loud? What happened to the design?
What's the answer?
To make them so loud? Hard mid-century modern surfaces are now in fashion. But even in the mid-century, when there were beautiful expanses of steel and wood, there were also white tablecloths and carpets and curtains,
which
there are
the
not now.
But that's a conscious decision. Because let me tell you where I think this started. And it's not mentioned in this piece, but I think I actually have a little bit of a sense. You're correcting me if I'm wrong. 20 plus years ago in New York City, when I would visit, I used to live there, but that was a lot longer ago, I would found that the exact same restaurants that I used to go to became a lot louder, mm-hmm. and it was conscious, because I remember having a discussion with one of the managers or wait people or whatever it is. And what they did, which is, what, by the way, what the old East Coast Grill did, very near where I live, which is no longer, is the ceilings were made of a certain something that... off which sound bounced. The point being that while you are put off by loud sound, a lot of restaurateurs decided that people were going to be engaged by magnification of sound. So it wasn't just that they changed the physical design of the restaurant. It was a conscious decision on the part of some restaurant owners who believed that more sound meant more life and would be more appealing to the customer. Am I not right about that?
And it is.
It is?
Oh, yeah. It's more appealing. I feel that I witnessed this seismic shift myself when the old Michaela's in Cambridge, Michaela Larson, had to get a sound guy in to think about hiding cottage cheese acoustic panels in the ceiling, which were already considered ugly and very out of it in the 80s. And... pads under the tables. Put your hands under the table sometimes and you'll find pads, because everyone was complaining about it. The chef she discovered, Todd English, went to Open Olives in Charlestown, and it had a fabulous eat at the bar and have the roast rotisserie chicken you would see behind the bar. Then an innovation to eat at the bar. And I went to his terrific restaurateur wife, Olivia, and I said, it's just so loud. Can you do something about this? And she said, I just crank it up. We need to do three turns tonight.
So where are you going to go in Cambridge? Where are you taking Greenspan?
I'm open to suggestion.
Really? By the way, do you know that Marjorie and I made... Now, we're not foodies like you are, nor are we famous in the food community. Marjorie and I made history as relates to Todd English.
Oh, gosh.
Do you know what this was? We can
say
reported, this is not going to hurt his business. No.
A fire.
We
no.
knew a person who worked in City Inspectional Services.
Mm-hmm.
So when his, I think, was it Olives in Charlestown?
It's Olives that
was
got
closed
into a lot
down
of
because of rats.
Rats.
We were tipped off that
yep.
it was about to be reopened
yep.
on a particular night. And we and some colleagues were the first people, in fact, the only people in the restaurant, because nobody else knew about it, a bunch of us, on the night at the post-rat reopening of Olives in Charlestown, which
yes.
is now legal, right? It's now legal,
closed,
right?
For sure.
Yeah.
Is Figs on Charles Street his only restaurant that's still here?
Figs is still here, and I don't know if it's the only one. No,
yeah.
I think that there's still a rustic kitchen maybe in... there's also Bonfire at the Park Plaza Hotel.
Oh, there is Bonfire.
So
okay.
there's plenty of Todd English presence, and his son is Oliver is becoming a great food activist.
Oh, I didn't
now,
know that.
Yeah, yeah.
What does he do?
He's terrific. He makes documentaries about sustainability,
oh,
and he's very compelling.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's great. Now, restaurants, how they got loud.
Yeah.
It is a conscious business decision to make restaurants loud so that people will order more alcohol and more food, which they do if it's loud.
Is that really true?
Yeah, it is. Wow. And to the delight of owners, they will leave sooner. But the issue that this, because when they leave sooner, it means more room
for
more
orders
and more money. But the very good writer Kate Wagner, who traces a lot of technological history in this piece, doesn't quite say is this should become the secondhand smoke issue for servers. It's damaging for back-to-back shifts, for servers to have to listen to this noise every night. And I hope that they start mobilizing against noise.
Hold on for 1 second. But do customers like it? I mean, I hate it. I can't be the only one that
hates it. It's hard to find customers who actually like it. But what restaurateurs will also will always tell you is younger people think this is a happening and successful place
if
it's loud.
If you go
at a dead old person's place if it's quiet.
Okay, you go to South Boston where everybody is now 22, and I mean, I want to shoot myself halfway through the meal. Everybody's yelling across the table. It's just crazy. But there should be maybe restaurants for 42-year-olds or 52-year-olds.
You know, yeah, 42-year-olds at the most. That's the most.
By the way, if the Globe reviews don't include what you just said, the Washington Post and others do, that is a wonderful and important idea for those who do care. Some may want it louder. Some may want it less loud. But that's a brilliant idea.
You know, the way some Southwestern restaurant reviews have a number of chilies and they're either filled in or not, definitely there are decibel levels for this.
Okay, so Corby Kummer, I don't care at all. I'm very happy for her. I don't care if, San Francisco has more three-star Michelin restaurants than any city in America. I know it was a big deal. I know it matters to the chef and to the owner. Does the consumer care anymore that somebody has three stars as opposed to two, as opposed to none? And by the way, we even mentioned this, as I said at the beginning, there's a woman chef out there who became the first in America, right? A woman to get three Michelin stars, to which I say, who cares?
So Michelin has tried to...
Michelin?
Yeah, the tire
and
man,
I said Michelin.
Fat
I feel
guy.
Really bad about
no,
it.
No, you're right. It's any way you want to say it, because the point is we're extending their brand reach into America by arguing over how to pronounce it.
We are. It's a very fine point.
We're only giving them free publicity. They want more of it. They want people to care about their ratings.
Does anybody care? When people are selecting restaurants, I would assume Yelp and TripAdvisor and newspaper reviews matter a hell of a lot more.
You had a terrible experience with TripAdvisor.
I did have a terrible experience, actually, in your second hometown of Hyannis. Yeah.
But how kind of you to include restaurant reviews or magazine reviews, because when I ask...
I actually often Google to see if you've written about a restaurant before I go to it, by the way.
Thank you very much, Jim. But when I recently said to a restaurateur whose restaurant closed, but we gave it such good reviews, it was so well-reviewed, are you saying that our reviews don't really matter to business? And he paused for a moment and he said, do I have to be the person who tells you? It's all TripAdvisor, which you used, and Yelp. This is what matters. As for Michelin and its famous three stars, I think it carries sway for people who think I need to spend a lot of money on an impressive occasion, and I assume that I'm going to get a certain level of service. I think, and most people who you care about food in this country or in Italy think they know nothing about Italian food, they know nothing about American food. They have very idiosyncratic standards that tend toward pomposity, very stilted originality and modernism. That's what they reward.
But can you be a non-pompous... That's what I was trying to say, and you said it before me, I think. Can you be a non-pompous restaurant and get three stars?
I think it's tough, because to get three stars, you have to have a certain level of service and formality, which are baked into their
but
ratings.
But is everybody screaming at the three-star restaurant, too, or can you go in there and hear yourself think?
No, they're not. I can't imagine a loud restaurant getting
three
stars.
That would be a reason to go, so you wouldn't have to hear the
shout.
But
so I didn't know why you so. I didn't know you were such a big... I like to be able to talk to people
because
when I go to a restaurant,
too. Because
I like
to have to shout at people that are 2 feet away from me to have them hear me, and I don't like to be so close to people, which is everywhere there now. You're like 6 inches. I mean, I'm not a big person. I would think to yourself, if you are a big person, you're trying to get out between those two tables, it's very embarrassing.
With the lack of community and connection in this country, you were saying you don't wish to be close to people, Marjorie?
I do not wish to be 6 inches.
Let me tell you something.
You are a big person.
It's not just about being a big person. Smaller people don't like being on top of other people, too.
But trying to get out from
here's
the tables.
Here's my suggestion.
What?
Not only should restaurant reviews have a sound... whatever it is. They should also have a space kind of thing. Can I say where you went the day after Thanksgiving? You don't want me to say.
Sarma. Yes.
Sarma is one of Anna Sortuna. She's a partner there. She owns Oleana, all this kind of stuff.
One of
the beauties of Sarma, and I think one of the reasons it's impossible to get into, is not just because the food is otherworldly great.
Yeah, it is.
But because you are not sitting on top of people. Is that not true?
Yep.
Isn't that a big deal?
I'll say where I did go when I was right on top of people with Tony Kuznir. I went to Carmelina's in the North End. The food was very good. I will never go there again because I couldn't get out of the seat.
And I have another nice thing to say about a local woman-owned restaurant.
Which one?
A woman and man-owned restaurant. It is Myers and Chang. So I've always loved Myers and Chang. Which is homestyle Chinese food, original, terrific,
fabulous.
Upbeat. But it was always a place I hesitated to go because of the noise. And then I went last week, and I took some out-of-towners, and I was surprised at how decent the noise level was. It seemed to have changed, and they seemed to have taken these mitigation steps that very few restaurant owners do.
And let me just say about the two of them, one of the nicest people ever, Joanne Chang, and her husband.
Chris Myers.
Yeah, they're great.
That was a joke, by the way, for those who weren't paying attention.
Yeah.
He's actually a sweetheart, too, but a different kind of
flower baker
character.
As well.
It's spectacular.
So let's talk about palm oil, which I have been seeing so much about lately, and terrible. What's happening with palm oil?
So this is this unintended consequence. When George W. Bush said, I'm going to announce a big push for biofuels because we can no longer be petrochemical dependent and have to worry about our relations with Gulf states, we're going to be energy independent. We're going to offer a subsidy for corn growers, and we're going to put it into ethanol and biofuel. And corn farmers loved this. This seemed to be ecologically friendly, and it was just going to help everybody. And it turned out to be a complete disaster because of, first of all, the raised prices for corn, the scarcity of corn for food industry that wanted it, the higher prices for oil, and then mostly it was the plundering of forests and deforestation and oxygen in the countries like Indonesia that weren't growing palm particularly but had the capacity to in the climate and started growing all these palms to compensate for the lack of petrochemicals and new energy independence. And when you read what this market did, it's slave labor, it's incredible lack and depredation of land in Indonesia, and a community by community, it has destroyed entire areas of Indonesia.
How come this has been so far, at least below the radar for me, and maybe I'm just uninformed, but one of the statistics in this piece that we read this morning was, what are they saying, the equivalent of 300 football fields is clear-cut every single day in the world to produce palm oil? That is surreal.
It is surreal, but what the piece in the New York Times did, it was also beautifully illustrated, it's one of their multimedia specials, was directly connect one policy decision, a speech made in the United States, to incredible deforestation on the other side of the world. And it quotes environmentalists as saying, this is going to be trouble. It looks good, but it's going to be trouble. And indeed, it turned out that way. And so a piece like this, which was paid for by ProPublica, a great nonprofit.
They've done fabulous things these days.
So it's really their credit that did that. Is, for example, if you try to get a smoking gun for obesity, it's not quite accurate to say that the low-fat movement led to high sugar, but there's some truth in it. It's trying to connect these dots. So what this palm oil piece did was say, not only are forests being clear cut, that's bad, it doesn't go into the Amazon, we know how terrible it is in the Amazon, But it just, it says, here's where the market's changed because of George Bush's speech. And so it draws this direct line to this environmental devastation.
What's palm oil in?
Everything.
Everything.
Yeah, palm oil is in lots of food.
So we should look for the ingredients and make sure we're not buying something.
Well, not just food.
Yeah, no, it's an industrial use. And the EPA is just not taking steps to try to change this.
Well, the EPA, as we know, is run now by a coal lobbyist. So right. I don't think we're going to get much help from the EPA in this administration.
Before we leave, can we end on an up note? Because this has been like too depressing.
Okay.
We've discussed the Farm Bill a lot with you here. We've discussed food stamp benefits. They're called SNAP benefits. A lot. There actually was a positive outcome out of the United States Congress, which sounds like the ultimate oxymoron, but actually it was a really good outcome, at least on the food stamp front, was it not?
A great outcome. So why did it happen? It's the deterrent effect of the midterm elections.
You think so?
So it's saying the House has changed. The House had passed this punitive version of the Farm Bill that imposed work requirements on people getting food stamps, which was going to have an enormous deterrent effect on especially young parents, because they're directly in the group that's supposed to prove you spent 20 hours a week looking for work. How do you prove that? How do you document it? And what the Trump administration cynically knew was, just by imposing this red tape, they would really reduce the rolls, which they consider to be welfare. The Senate said, no, we're not going to do that. The Senate has always been protective of food stamps.
And the Republican-led Senate, since we criticized the Republicans there a lot,
And also the Trump administration within the previous or the current House, but in the lame duck, also tried to get rid of a lot of environmental protections, because it's hard to remember that the Farm Bill is also one of the chief environmental protection bills passed by the U.S. government. And they were trying to, there's something called the Conservation Stewardship Program, cover crops, graze pasture, work to minimize pesticide applications. All these things are great. And the House version said, no more money for it. Forget that stuff. We're going to protect industrial agriculture. That's back. And so the deal in principle, not signed yet, but announced last week, is saying no work requirements for food stamps, and we're going to keep these conservation measures.
For 5 years, am I not right?
Yeah, it's in force for 5 years.
By the way, before you go, we only have 30 seconds left. When you ask what's palm oil in, let me just read a line from this piece here. It can be found in 40% of everyday products on supermarket shelves, from donuts to shampoo, chips to ice cream, even appears in the gas tank of your car. So the answer is do a little research. Good to see you, Corby Kummer.
Great to see you.
Thank you very much, Corby Kummer. Award-winning food writer Corby Kummer joins us every week. He's senior editor at The Atlantic and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy. Thanks, Corby. Coming up, CNN's John King is here to go over the latest headlines flying out of Washington, D.C. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.